Thank you, David, for taking the time to chat. I'd love to ask you about Techstars, your leadership, and then talk a little bit about your personal blog, your leadership style, as well as your investment philosophy. So if there's no other kind of comments on your end, I'd love to start off by asking about the culture of Techstars. As we know, with any organization, kind of culture comes from the top, and I'm assuming that to a large extent that Techstars culture is an embodiment of your own personality and background, and I'd love to understand that that's the case and how exactly the culture evolved.
Sure. So I would actually say that it's the combination of the founders' cultures. The founders of Techstars, there are four of us. Right. So I've been the active one since the very beginning and kind of the original operator. But Brad Feld, Jared Polis, and David Brown are also founders. And I would say, David Brown and I have been working together for 15 years prior to starting Techstars together. So we're now at about 25. And certainly he and I have developed this culture of, give first, be helpful to people without any expectation of return. Brad, around that time, had a very similar ethos, still does, obviously, and he called it give before you get, which is really the same notion. And, of course, Jared's been a tremendous public servant for Colorado, and has done a lot for a lot of people through the power of entrepreneurship. So I think it's the synthesis of all of us, and it's not that, we created it, it's that we had already been living it and, wanted to capture it in a few words and give first for those words. Just simply the idea of, being helpful to entrepreneurs with no transactional expectation of return. So, when we started Techstars, it was very natural and already something that we all did regularly anyway.
Got it. That's helpful. And I think when I visited you guys a year and a half ago, I noticed kind of how low-key everything seemed to be. And reading your blog post, and I think you said, tell me if I'm misquoting you, you have a natural tendency to quote unquote shut up and perform, and being splashy isn't really in your authentic natural tendency. How do you weigh that, like being kind of giving first versus being more splashy so that you can spread your word, spread the message more widely and help more entrepreneurs succeed?
Yeah, it's a great question and one we talk about a lot. I mean, I usually say shut up and execute, but shut up and perform is the same sentiment, which I'm sure I've said before. For me, it's the most difficult thing about the early stage investment ecosystem is, so many people waving their arms around, look at me, and so many people, who I don't necessarily think are, strong investors, but who have the reputation, right, for being strong because they're good at that self-promotion, and more power to them. I mean, that is clearly attractive to a lot of people, but, I think it's our ethos to shut up and execute. And so, we haven't been huge marketers. We've not spent a lot of money on marketing. We try to spend money on results and actually helping entrepreneurs succeed. We're 10 years in. People know the brand around the world. We're investing in 13 or 14 countries now. We have hundreds of thousands of people going through the system every year through Startup Weekend and Startup Week and our accelerators and our investment platform. And so, obviously now we do some marketing on some level, but we try to make it authentic and we try to make it about our companies. Because that's what is exciting, I think, to entrepreneurs is to be like SendGrid or PillPack, right, or ClassPass or, Twilio or other companies that we've invested in that have done well and have leveraged the Techstars worldwide network to help them achieve that success. So, I think we'll continue being ourselves. I don't know who said it, but everybody else is taken is a good quote. And, we'll just be ourselves authentically and continue to shut up and execute.
That makes a lot of sense. And it seems like it's a natural kind of theme in reading your posts and everything you guys say, being authentic. So that's important. Have you ever personally had to change an aspect of your personality as a leader, whether it was 10, 15, 20 years ago or sometime more recently? Have you had to change yourself for the better in some way? And if so, how?
So Yeah, I'd say yes and no. I mean, you know, yes in the sense that, you know, we all have weaknesses, and I certainly have plenty of them, and I've worked on those weaknesses. You know, I'd say an example of that has been selling in my past. I never thought of myself as good at selling or, you know, sort of building strong personal relationships with the purpose of selling. I've had to learn how to do that, you know, as one of the general partners in our venture funds, you know, relationships with limited partners, you know, who are really important to what you're doing really matters, and selling to them really matters. So, you know, you work on yourself even though it's not who you are, and that's normal and okay. I would say personality-wise, no, I don't want to change personality-wise. You know, I kind of am old enough now that I'm, you know, comfortable in my own skin and locked on who I am. But you obviously work on the skills that you have. So I think I just, you know, draw a line between those two things.
Got it. Yeah, that sounds like it's working out for you. And kind of along similar lines, change is difficult. But what has been one of your more difficult decisions as a leader, whether tech stars or otherwise?
Well, you know, one that comes to mind is I think a tactical error we made early on, which we corrected, and it was hard to correct. And that was, you know, in the beginning, in the early days of Techstars, we really had this drive to help people succeed, help entrepreneurs be successful in what they were doing. And we had created something, you know, back then the word accelerator exists, right? Brad Bell, what the co-founders are, coined that word. And that became what this activity is called today. And then it became the overused version of it. But what we mean by it is when we invest in short-term mentorship-driven acceleration. You know, I think when people started calling us nonstop and saying, hey, I see that you're doing Techstars in Boulder, you know, maybe we're in Boston by then, you know, two cities, now we're at 44 locations, right? But like back then, small, people were saying, how do we do what you're doing? And our instinct, unlike some of our competitors, was to say, well, here's how we do it. You know, you should go build something like this because it'll help entrepreneurs succeed. That's what we care about. So we're going to teach you how to do it. And it soon got to the point where we were spending half our time teaching others how to copy what we were doing, right? And a lot of people say, well, you're crazy. You're creating competitors, right? Why are you doing that? And the answer is simple. We want to help more entrepreneurs succeed, and this is a way to scale that. Well, at some point, we started to allow themselves to attach to us a little too closely. We had a bunch of accelerators around the world that we were not operating, that we weren't investing in, that we really had not much to do with other than being mentors to them. And they started attaching the word Techstars to what they were doing, and we sort of didn't stop them from doing that quickly enough. So we had to unwind all of that, and that's when we created an organization called the Global Accelerator Network, which we don't own or control. We just created a separate company, staffed it, and, you know, we gave it a loan, and now it's its own thing that has literally no control and ownership from us, called the Global Accelerator Network, which helps other accelerators succeed. So we decided we wanted to focus directly on helping entrepreneurs succeed, not helping accelerators succeed, and in turn, them helping others, because, you know, the mistake there is don't put your brand on something that you're not operating, right? So I think that's one big thing that we learned early on.
That's helpful. And speaking of kind of the Techstar brand and how you guys operate, you guys have managing directors in different cities, and it's you have a kind of a networked system where the managing director reports to the general manager, who reports to you as the CEO or the Techstar CEO. And you guys train the managing directors, but ultimately some of the investment decisions are made at the centralized level. And I want to understand a little bit about how the interaction between the managing directors and the corporate level happens. What do you guys do when disagreements come up? How often do those disagreements come up? If you have any specific examples, that might be helpful just to understand kind of the decision-making process at the highest levels.
Sure. Yeah, so Techstars is probably the highest velocity seed accelerator in the world, seed investor in the world, really. We fund about 450 companies a year now through the accelerators out of about 20,000 that apply. I don't think there's anybody else in the world that funds that many companies every year. So, you know, I think that's thing one. It's just different because of that velocity. You know, the managing directors do report in more or less the way you described, actually up through our operations team. You know, we train them to be great investors. There's more than 40 of them now. They are in touch with their local markets. You know, they're the people in New York and Paris and Boston and LA and, you know, Berlin and Singapore, right, on the ground, participating authentically in the community, you know, in the ecosystem, looking for the next great companies to put through the TechStars programs in those locations. They have a lot of autonomy to go and source great companies. That's what we want them to do. And then when they bring those companies to us, you know, if there's some kind of disagreement, and typically that would be around brand. You know, maybe there's a company that's, you know, doing something that's off-brand for TechStars, whether that's something in the space of illegal drugs or, you know, pornography, just to pick a few examples. You know, we would just say no. And they understand that. Everything they invest in is capital coming from our structure and our system. They're an employee. You know, TechStars locations, these accelerators are not franchises. They're all directly owned and operated, right? So, you know, it's a relationship where ultimately we have control of what we want to do as investors. And so, you know, it's fairly natural. It's like any reporting structure in any organization. Someone says, I want to do this thing. It smells a little bit funny this way. And we tell them yes or no. You know, so, but by and large, they're in touch with their local community, and most of the companies are going to bring us, you know, we want to back them in their process because, you know, they're the ones that are there living on the ground with these great companies. And, you know, as long as we don't believe it's a bad investment or off-brand, we tend to support that.
Got it. That makes a lot of sense. Can you talk a little bit more about the relationship between your corporate sponsors and TechStars? If whatever you're comfortable with divulging, like how much do corporates usually provide, and like what is that money used for normally?
Yeah, so what you're referring to is TechStars operates accelerators on behalf of major corporations and in partnership with major corporations. So just to make it real and give you an example, you know, the Barclays accelerator is powered by TechStars. What does that mean? That means that Barclays has come to us to execute an accelerator for them. We run it. We hire people the same way as we hire people for our TechStars New York or TechStars LA program. Those people work in our system the same way. It's just that the branding works a little bit differently. And sometimes, in most cases, we split the investment with those partners. So you can just think of it as a joint venture that, you know, we're investing together in the next generation of startups that are in the world that that particular partner would care about. So in the case of Barclays FinTech, or in the case of Amazon Voice and AI, in the case of Ford, you know, Mobility, and so on. So we can stand up that accelerator, invest in the activity together, leverage the TechStars worldwide network to source those companies and to help them succeed, right, while the partner is also sort of giving first into that equation, investing in these startups. Through us, we manage all of that, so it just feels to the startups like TechStars is investing. And yeah, they obviously providing mentorship, people from their C-suite. You know, there's opportunities to get deals done with those large corporations. But ultimately, we're co-investing with those partners to create the next great startups in those spaces without any adverse selection. So classical corporate innovation is not going to attract the best entrepreneurs because they don't want necessarily these corporations on their cap tables so early on because it limits downstream opportunities with competitors of that company or exit opportunities. Here, TechStars is the investor. We provide all the best of having these partnerships like the mentorship and the give first, but we don't have the corporations having any control, board seats, things like that. So you can still attract great entrepreneurs that way.
Got it. That makes a lot of sense. So they're like a true partner.
Absolutely, for sure.
Great. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about your approach to LPs? Like, what makes for a good LP in your opinion? And have you ever said no to anyone before? When someone's an LP in TechStars, are they investing all across TechStars, or can they choose a certain geography?
Yeah. So limited partners. You know, for our venture platform, which includes the accelerators, seed, and series A, so that's kind of the spectrum of what we do. We've absolutely said no to people before. You know, there's been nine-figure no's that we've gotten to just on culture, fit, intent? You know, what are they trying to do? Are they trying to take out of the ecosystem, or do they want to participate in helping entrepreneurs succeed? So you want ethos alignment, but you also want people that are going to be supportive and helpful. And we're really privileged to have a great set of limited partners that, you know, are very sort of aligned with the mission. And that's a big part of, you know, what we talk about, what we care about, helping those entrepreneurs succeed. Not how do we, you know, unfairly extract more ownership or something. Not that other, you know, VCs do that, but, and I think you want people who are there for the long run. That's another big part of it. You know, there's plenty of, you know, family offices or smaller investors or whatever that don't really have a program. You know, when we take an investment from an LP, you know, usually they're telling us they're there for 3 to 5 funds at least, right? Like, even if things don't go as they expect, they're going to be there for us. And that's because they have a program where they're actually allocating capital into a strategy and we fit that strategy. So, you know, I would just caution, you know, micro funds and other mistakes I've been through in, you know, earlier years that you can avoid would be, you know, don't just take any money you can find, just like what you'd say to an entrepreneur.
Yep.
Because if that investor is not there for the next round, it's a negative signal, right? And if they're, you know, more difficult than helpful, that's a problem too. So it's very similar to who you want to take money from as an entrepreneur.
Got it. That's helpful. One thought that came to mind when you were talking about kind of learning how to sell better over time. Do you have any advice for people in our late 20s, early 30s, whether we're entrepreneurs or not, and how to become more self-aware of our strengths and weaknesses and act appropriately, given your own personal experience?
Absolutely. I mean, everybody's still learning all the time, right? To me, the most effective thing that I've done in my career to really be introspective and learn is two. One is a CEO coaching. I mean, when you get a great CEO coach, a partnership coach, you know, it's not about the business. It's about you and your strengths and weaknesses. And that's super valuable to have somebody that's really great at seeing it in you and just telling you, right, in a trusted way. And two is 360 reviews. You know, I know those are somewhat popular now, but like, that's where I've learned the most about myself. You know, the growth area is where you think you're good at something, but your peers think you're weak at it, right, or not good at it. And so, you know, just having a group of people that will give you that honest feedback and asking for it, not like, hey, come in and tell me today, but as a rhythm, surfaces things that, you know, you realize about yourself. And early in my career, right, one of the things was, hey, you're a conflict avoider. I was like, what? I'm a conflict avoider? You know, let's fight about that, right, ironically. But you know, people would tell me that. I said, well, yeah, I don't really think I'm avoiding conflict. And they say, yeah, you are, right? And so I still identify with conflict avoidance, but I've learned how to recognize it in myself, confront it, and deal with it. And, you know, I've been really proud of myself in the last, say, 5 years for some things I've done that I could have had other people do or hidden from. And these things are never as bad as you think they're going to be. But, I, you know, you don't realize it until you hear it about yourself from your peers over and over.
Got it. That's, yeah, very helpful advice. So the two key things are CEO coaches and 360-degree reviews.
For sure. Yeah.
Cool. I'd love to talk a little bit about your personal blog. I've read many of the articles, and I really like the Assume Good Intent blog post from, I think, August a year ago. August 2017, and I think it's a very important principle, and try to incorporate it into my life personally. And can you maybe provide an anecdote, an example of a time when someone did something that could have been seen as offensive, and you correctly assume kind of good intent, and things turned out well as a result?
Yeah, we have a lot of this. You know, it's another mantra inside of Techstars, because we're now, you know, well over 200 people, but we're scattered around the world, right? And so when you have an organization that is highly distributed, this becomes really important. It's important anyway, but one of the reasons I wrote that is because of an actual situation that happened, where we had an employee who sent a note that on the surface was kind of, you know, putting the hand up and saying, go away, right? Like, no, I don't want to do that. And it really offended people on the other end who were, you know, probably 5,000 miles away. And I heard people talking about, oh, that person, you know, they just won't do it. Well, just pick up the phone and, like, assume good intent. Like, maybe they're saying that because it's important to their mission, you know, helping entrepreneurs succeed or their department for some reason. So, you know, don't just, like, grind on it. You know, talk to people. And if you assume they have good intent, then you'll make a phone call and say, I'm just curious why that, you know, answer came back that way, because it seems like it'd be helpful to, you know, do this thing. And often you'll get back, well, here's actually what's going on, and you'll find a solution. So, you know, it's true in portfolio companies with boards. You know, sometimes people take things the wrong way or they deliver them the wrong way. And the thing to remember is it's not what is said, it's what's heard, right? That's how people internalize stuff. You may mean something totally innocent, but people may hear it the wrong way. So if you assume good intent, you come at it with the right attitude, then if there's bad intent, you can deal with it. But it, in my experience, it's rarely the case.
Got it. And in those rare cases, have you generally have been able to act like swiftly and avoid any negative consequences thereafter?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if it's truly bad intent, you want to deal with that, right? I mean, that might be letting somebody go or correcting their worldview, right?
Right.
You know, if they're in an organization that you control. But, you know, when most of the time, in my experience, like the thing that you're pissed off about, that you're spending cycles and energy on getting angry about, there's a nuance to it, right? And it just takes a conversation.
Right, yeah, definitely have experienced that myself in the past, but that's a really helpful perspective. Another blog post I really enjoyed was your Don't Make Yourself Indispensable post from February 2017. And I'm just wondering, as TechStars grows, are you personally becoming more or less indispensable? And if so, how so?
Yeah, I think I'm following the advice, you know, of the 200 plus people in the organization, and there's one person that works for me, and that's my poor executive assistant who has to report up to me, but that's just how we do it here. Everybody else doesn't work for me, so, you know, we have an organization that, you know, works without me in the line, which is awesome because I'm not a manager, right? I'm an investor. I'm a strategist. I like to think I help with that stuff at the board level, but I have a team that executes. And so, you know, I'm in a place now where if I walked out of the building for a month, like I have high confidence that good decisions would be made and things would, you know, would work, because I have a great team around me. So that's kind of the message is, you know, if you have to be there to make it work, you're not doing your job in an ironic way. And it's something that I think a lot of CEOs don't think about. Because, you know, you might get hit by a bus or you might want to take a month off, right, for your mental health. And if you can't do that and you're indispensable, I think you built something that, you know, can come crumbling down as quickly as anything you've ever seen.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And it seems like everything you told me about TechStars and everything I know, it seems like you've really kind of structure the organization in a way that kind of fits your personality and really works for you. And by structuring it almost selfishly in a way that works for you, you made it successful, or your team has made it successful.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say part of it is I've also built it to my strengths, right? I mean, I don't want to spend time managing people. I want to spend time finding great investments, you know, sitting on those boards, helping those entrepreneurs succeed. You know, influencing the strategy of TechStars, but not the day-to-day, you know, personnel issues and whatever else that are just not my strength. So, you know, it's part of this question you asked earlier about becoming self-aware. Right? You learn what you're good and bad at, and you can work on the things you're bad at, but you're probably never going to be great at them. So, you know, you sort of take that data and you build an organization that can be successful.
Got it. That's fascinating. I've read a lot of and talked to people with similar mindsets, and kind of focusing on your strengths rather than your weaknesses seems to be everything to an extent. There seems to be some commonality there that leads to long-term success and happiness.
Yep, I agree.
Got it. And the last blog post I'd love to talk about is a little more of a personal touch. I really was touched by your September 2016 tribute to your late father, and you mentioned his kindness as one of the highlights of your memory, and I was just wondering, would you say that kindness is kind of imbued in yourself, and it seems like maybe by the transit property kind of expressed in that gift-first ethos and culture of Techstars, and want to understand if there are any other kind of personality traits in your father that that you have derived that are kind of embodied in the organization that you've built?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you can draw a straight line to it, but I'd like to think that the Techstars is a good organization and a kind organization with a mission that's both, you know, important in the world, but also has an economic driver, right? We want to participate in the success of these entrepreneurs by enabling it. You know, I think the key thing I was really saying in that post, it's now been 22 years since, you know, he died, and I think of him still all the time, right? I have the recurring dream I mentioned in there. I've had it in the last few months, right? So I still see him as being part of my life in a weird way. But I think the key thing is, like, when you lose someone and, you know, time passes, it really gets encapsulated into a few things, right? In this case, it was kindness and, you know, entrepreneurship, right? He was an entrepreneur, and obviously that's impacted my life in a huge way, watching him build his company. You know, it was an accounting firm with probably 20 or 30 people in it, but, you know, the way that he built the business, you know, with integrity and that same kindness, I think has impacted me. It's part of who I am, and hopefully it's part of who Techstars is. So, you know, it's been long enough that, you know, you have the space to reflect on it. And so I would encourage anybody that's had a loss, you know, wait 5, 10 years, however long, and really try to capture what it means for them. And, you know, I can't tell you, I recently had another friend who, you know, lost their father. I sent them that post and I said, I'm thinking of you. And they said that was so great to read, right? So it's cathartic, I think, to do that.
Got it. Well, thank you for sharing that personal perspective on the post a couple years ago and then just now again. I really appreciate it. I'd like to shift the conversation a little bit and talk a little more about your investment philosophy. Can you talk a little bit about your mental models, kind of the key things you look for when making a seed investment? Obviously, there are things that all investors look for, but if there's anything that really helps that really stands apart from how other people that you know think about the world, that'd be very interesting, I think.
Yeah, I don't know if it stands apart, but I'll tell you the, you know, I mean, there's all the obvious stuff that I'm sure people say, you know, team and market and, you know, execution. But the one that you know, I really try to create mental space for is imagining the world in 20 years. I always think that's 20 years is sort of the right time frame. You know, I'm not an investor that wants to invest for 2 years or 4 years. I don't think anything meaningful gets built on that time frame. But the question I try to give myself space for is, what would the world look like if this was successful in 20 years? And would that matter? Right? Would it be like, oh, okay, great, that exists? Or would it be like, wow, that's really different? You know, taking Uber as an easy example, right? I'm an investor in the first round of Uber when it was, didn't have any cars on the road, but sitting there that day with Ryan Graves and talking about, you know, how anyone will be able to push a button and get transportation to anywhere in the future, like, it resonated with me, right? I imagine 20 years from now, well, I want to go to Kansas City today, and I'm in Denver, so I push a button, and there's a plane, and I go get on the plane, right? Or I push a button, and I get in a car, the way we all think is normal today, didn't exist back then. And so it's sort of a shared vision of the future with the entrepreneur in a 20-year time frame that I really think about. And if in 20 years I think, okay, that was a business that worked but didn't really have any impact, it's probably not a great investment. But if that's a business that worked that people have heard of and say, thank you for changing the world, that's the one I want to invest in.
Got it. That's helpful. So is there anything, maybe it is like seeing the world in 20 years, but is there anything in particular that you do better than most other investors? Is there anything you can point to that you think, okay, I'm better at this aspect? And kind of conversely, are there things that you do less well than other investors? And any blind spot that you personally have?
Yeah. I mean, I think the better part, you know, if I'm pitching an entrepreneur and it's me against somebody else, is I've seen more startups than they have. It almost doesn't matter who they are, right? I've seen more things go wrong and more things go right and more companies than they have, right? I'm over 1,500 investments. You know, I've seen unicorns. I've seen huge failures and everything in between, right? Second thing would be network. You know, three tech stars I'm bringing to the table, one of the biggest networks in the world. Those are entrepreneurs. That's, you know, interesting for talent. Corporations that want to do business with you. If there's somebody you want to talk to, I can probably get to them. Right. And I think other investors say that, but I don't know that they can point at the same type of network that is real. So those are the two things that I usually try to sell on. You know, I think if it's, you know, what am I maybe weaker at than other investors? Look, there's some phenomenal individual investors in the world that are just, you know, the smartest people you're ever going to sit in a room with that, you know, can dissect a business model or a challenge with a specific type of business model in 5 seconds. It might take me longer, right? Yeah, I've seen it before, but I haven't put that pattern together. So there's some people who are specialists. And actually, the advice I give entrepreneurs is go get a specialist and then go get someone like Techstars that brings massive, massive global network to the table, you know, and a lot of sort of variety of experience. It's just like going to the doctor. You know, you want the specialist for your heart problem, but you also need a generalist to help you figure out you have a heart problem. And if that generalist can bring 10 specialists to the table through their network, that's really helpful too, right?
Got it. I like analogies are a kind of great way to make the world a little simpler, helps us remember things. So I like that analogy a lot. Yeah. You mentioned, I think I was in a blog post or something, you said that instinct really matters. I guess maybe we've covered this already with the future in 20 years. Are there any other kind of anecdotes regarding instinct or any other points you want to make about instinct really mattering that you'd like to share?
Yeah. So, you know, the book on this would be Blank. Many people have read. First impressions matter a lot. Due diligence is a great way to talk yourself out of making a great investment. And I try to pay a lot of attention to, like, that spark I get from the first meeting. Uber is an example I gave you. I only had one meeting. I was instantly, you know, really liked Ryan. You know, SendGrid is another one I'll give you. You know, they went public last year. I was on the board there from 2009 to 2017, right before the IPO. And the instinct on that company on day one was like, wow, I really like these people. Right? I mean, that was it. I love the entrepreneurs. And, you know, we put two more CEOs in that company as it grew. It wasn't that they were the team that was going to take it all the way by themselves, but they stayed through the whole thing, and they were the founding spirit of that company. It's an email, you know, provider company that now trades publicly. It's $1.3 billion
right, yeah,
now.
You use them.
Yep. And you know, I almost talked myself out of investing. They were right on the bubble for getting into the Techstars Accelerator because they sort of lacked a few things that we were looking for. From a due diligence perspective, one of the founders couldn't come to Boulder for the program, you know, so they were going to be split up for 3 months, and they didn't seem to have a person who was going to be the long-term CEO. And those are great ways to talk yourselves out of investment. But I kept going back to, like, that first meeting I had in an airport, you know, sports bar with Isaac, right? And just remembering, you know, the feeling that I had. And so I think, you know, you have to balance stuff and take a chance on things that just feel right. As an investor, that's worked out for me pretty well.
Got it. So it seems like the instinct is largely related to kind of reading people, that human personal interaction when you're interacting with founders.
Yeah, this is a good person who's actually mission-driven, right?
And yeah.
Not just going off of a spreadsheet, not just, you know, trying to solve a problem because they think it'll make them money, but they care about it, and they're going to stop at nothing to get it done. You can feel that in a first meeting in a way that due diligence can undo.
Interesting. I'd love to kind of dive into this a little more. Are there, how do you read someone beyond like what they're saying, because everyone will say, like, I really care about this, I'm going to work on this, I'm really fix this multi-billion-dollar problem. Are there tangible signals that you look for when you size someone up? Any hints, like body language, gestures? Like, how do you become better at reading people is another way of asking this.
Yeah, because they can be really practiced too, right? I mean, and we teach those skills, right? We teach entrepreneurs. I'll give you an example that's kind of famous around Techstars, but you know, if you know you're going to be asked a question, like, what will you do if Google does this? It's a common investor question. You need to know exactly what you want to say because it's a common question. And so these entrepreneurs can practice and they say, well, three things, you know, we'll do this, that, and the other because I've thought about it. So one of the keys is to ask uncommon questions that people couldn't possibly be prepared for.
Mm-hmm.
And get a vibe, like, are they being genuine with you? Or are they willing to say, you know, I never thought about that? Or, I don't know. And I love those answers because the best entrepreneurs will turn those into, I don't know, so can we talk about that? That's really interesting to me. I want to come away from this with something on that. And they almost forget they're in an interview and they're really just focused on making their company better. So, you know, even if something is really out there, do they dismiss it? Do they say, yeah, great idea, let's do that? Or do they say, well, I want to talk about that and learn more? And I find the latter is a signal. But a lot of it, you know, I would stress is just the feeling you get, right? Instinct is instinct, and blink is the moment where, you know, you don't have the data, and just it feels right. And I'm not saying you make a decision based on that, but some of my best investments ever have been things that felt right that I spent 15, 20 minutes with. And invested without much due diligence, and they turned out great.
Got it. That's fascinating. Side note, I asked that same question, like, how do you read people? I was fortunate to attend a business school trip to Omaha in December of last year and got the chance to ask Warren Buffett a question in front of, like, 400 people. But I asked him that same question, and frankly, your answer was much better because he kind of avoided the question and didn't really answer it at all, but he's obviously very good at reading people too, and I think it's underappreciated skill as an investor, that qualitative ability to read people. So that's really helpful.
I agree. I mean, there's lots of, you know, if you're a police officer, you know how to tell if somebody's lying, right? I feel like I can tell that, and you know what's most fascinating about all of this is sometimes you're just wrong, right? Someone asked me earlier today, hey, David, if you would have met Travis instead of Ryan, do you think you would have invested in Uber? And I said, I have no idea. Right? I don't know Travis. I've never met him. You know, all I've ever read about in the media is this and that, but that's all secondhand. And how would it have felt in that moment? I don't know. Right? And so I might have missed an investment because it wasn't Ryan. It didn't blink and feel great. Right?
That's fascinating. Yeah. No. Good work on that one. I have just a few questions left. One of the last questions is, if you weren't doing what you're doing now, what do you think you'd be doing?
Well, Techstars is definitely the last thing I want to do. So I'd probably be, you know, professionally anyway, I'd probably be traveling, playing a lot more tennis, and learning a lot more about quantum mechanics, which I'm fascinated with. I'll never be able to be a professional in that field, but I'd love to have professionals tell me why my ideas are so stupid and learn more about it, because it's just a fascinating world that has a lot of implications. But, you know, I think traveling and tennis are the other two things.
Very cool. Very cool. What's something about your investment approach with Techstars or you personally that would surprise most people that don't know you very well?
About my investment approach.
Or Techstars, it's just something that most people that haven't met you wouldn't know.
I don't think, you know, there's still a lot of people in the world that don't really understand the scope and scale of what we do. The velocity, you know, we invest at, and, you know, we're now sourcing around 5% of all the U.S. Series A's that happen. So 1 in 20 Series A's that somebody's going to fund are coming through our system. And that number is growing fast. So, you know, look, I think we have access to stuff, to deals that are interesting. And I think, you know, a lot of folks in the Bay Area or, you know, around the world may not realize the scope and scale of it all these days.
Awesome. And last question is, what is there anything else that I could be asking or should have asked that you want to cover?
You should always ask, you know, how did we meet?
Yeah.
so that people know what the context is, but
yeah. Edit this and put that in the front or something, I don't know.
Good. Yeah, no, I always love hearing the latest of what you're up to, and, you know, I would say, you know, you're one of those meetings I have where I was like, yeah, this person's going to do some things, and, I want to stay in the world, so it's exciting to see the progress of everything you're doing as well.
Got it. Well, thank you. And just a funny anecdote about 36 Names, the domain leasing platform. You were luckily one of our first customers. Unfortunately, you were one of our only customers. So, I think.
Well, that shows my taste in products, I guess. But no, I it was a useful product to me. And, you know, I actually transacted several things because of you guys. So
I'm glad, yeah.
But fun to see you shift gears and get to new stuff. So,
yeah, definitely. Thank you. Yeah.